going to ask you to come up. Anybody that wants to share, just come right up here and use this microphone to share.
We want to make sure everyone hears.
Yeah.
I don't think I need a microphone. Oh. You can all hear me?
No.
Want me to hold it for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
This quilt is a representation of my journey over the last 8 years or so. Since my wife died, I began quilting, and I've made over 50 quilts. But representative of my journey from as long back as I can remember is my creativity. And creativity is what nourishes my soul. Mm-hmm. And it takes the form of many things, blacksmithing and woodworking and knife making and quilting and making lace. I started lace 3 years ago.
What does this symbolize?
This is just a quilt without corners. I call it the purple quasar.
That's creativity. Very good.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, you've probably heard enough about Iona, but I have a little more to say. I went there in the year 2000. I went alone, I wasn't in a pilgrimage, and it was just wonderful. It is a long, circuitous journey, as you probably heard from the others. Went on the Flying Scotsman from London to Edinburgh, from Edinburgh to Oban, no, from Edinburgh to Glasgow, and from Glasgow to Oban, to then to Craigdure and Fianport, two ferries. Anyway, Iona is the same that it might have been when Colm Kyll went there. No paved roads, no electric lights on the outside, no night lights, I must say the part I did discover that thin space that Martha has been talking about in the nunnery there, the old ruin, and I just wanted to sit there, and tears would come easily to your eyes, just sitting there. You didn't want to read, you didn't want to do anything else, but take in the tranquility of the place. It was really beautiful.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Thank you.
That's my story. Yeah.
The nunnery was also the place on Iona that I found most special, and it's interesting that it's one that Philip talks about in the book as being a special place. It's interesting. It was commissioned and built by St. Margaret of Scotland. So St. Margaret's important on Iona too.
And hold some for you. Yeah, sure.
I had the privilege of going with the adult education in 2003 to the west of Ireland, and many of you know Gail Campanella. I'm sorry she's not here today because she was my roommate, and we went to what I was telling some friends just today, blasts of John O'Donohue's. He was our mentor and a wonderful, wonderful spirit. And it was, in a way, returning home when I read this summer that we were going to do Celtic spirituality at Word and Life, because this group has become a very special place for me. And I was remembering my UFOs, my unfinished objects in drawers that I put away. One of them was a quilting project that I had started 10 years ago before I went to Ireland. And so I've been connecting with my roots, and I was thinking about these chairs we sit on, and so feverishly in September before we started, I finished the pillow, and then the creativity continued to blossom, and I wrote a poem about the pillow. I have just created a plump happiness to sit upon, to decorate, to celebrate. Sewn in Celtic interlace, its surface reminds me of many things, mostly my mother. Her love of needle and thread, joyful making of useful objects, always finely crafted, signed with a heart, no matter the crude odds and ends, reborn from the oblivion of another's rummage. I aspire to her rare grace and generous spirit, but require refinements she never seemed to need. Bias bars, quilting feet, accessories and fabrics, all splendid green choices in an obscene stash of purchases. Now I think upon the Celts, their wisdom, my heritage, this heartbeat of nature woven over and under, around and through my life, like a grand cushion of ancestors, roots in Wales and Scotland, Ireland and England. This pillow is my present and gentle call to honor these rhythms and peoples of a primal past, ancient, yet so recent, as I carry this soft music of voices, sounds and chords of interwoven harmonies on my path.
I just want to say how I just love hearing everybody's bits and pieces, because you get to know people by their stories and what they share. So, thank you. And the quilter, where is it? Oh, I don't know what to say. I mean, that's beautiful. Last week we saw a film about Iona, and then today our guest speaker talked about Skellig Michael, and I went on a tour, Unique Tours of Ireland with UCSB in 1998. And I just wanted to give you a little bit about Skellig and then my experience there. Skellig Michael is in the Atlantic Ocean, and there's two. There's a large Skellig and a small one. The small one looks like a condo of white birds. There's 27,000 of them. And it's in the Ring of Kerry in County Kerry. And it was there from the early Christian times for 600 years, and it until the Normans came, and that took a couple. I'm not sure of all the history, but it took a couple of times, and they starved the head monk and the abbot. It was pretty gruesome, but I didn't go into all that. I didn't want to know all of it. But it's the trip over is like a pilgrimage within a pilgrimage, because the Atlantic Ocean, as you can imagine, is cold, and I kept saying, where are the life preservers, because you couldn't see them, and I looked in the side whether you think there would be. There were none, so it would be maybe death if you fell over. I don't know, but that's part of the pilgrimage, I guess. So, and people were heaving, and I loved it. I went up with the captain who spoke Gaelic, and the boat was literally like this, and I'm like, I love that, but not everybody does, but it's part of the journey. And when you get there, I was thinner than I am now, but I was not in the best of shape, and I thought, it's 12 kilometers to the island, to Big Skellig, and we had to wait 2 days for the weather to clear. And I'm just giving you bits and pieces here. St. Michael stands is in honor of St. Michael, because he was the saint of high places. It's 715 feet high and 600 steps. And I thought, I got to do this. And so I said, okay,
12 steps, one step at a time. That's literally how I did it, one step at a time. So that in itself was a spiritual experience. These little puffins were all along the way, and they're just so cute. The sandstone, when you get up to the top, the sandstone that makes the beehive huts is 350 million years old. It's D-E-V-O-N-I-A-N, sandstone. And those huts are beveled into, you know, like this, and they're rounded in the top. They're still the same. And I went inside to pray, and it's like this incredible experience to be not only on top of Skellig Michael, but within the beehive hut itself. So basically, just to go on this tour, and also to Wicklow. If you go to Dublin, you must go to Wicklow. It's an incredible experience. The best way I can explain how I felt, I think it's already been said today, is the change of the heart, the inner and the outer come into balance. And it's, you have all this quiet and beauty outside yourself, but you also, it becomes part of you on the inside. So there's a space on the outside, and I think more space on the inside. And it does shift you, or did shift me. And I will never, ever, ever forget it. And just seeing your film on Wicklow brought me back, too. So thank you.
You may remember those pictures. I believe it was last week. They had the pictures of Skellig Michael, which was that little, looked like an ice cream cone out in the middle of the ocean. Okay.
I looked at my sort of sacred objects that I and my pilgrimage objects, but they seemed more like souvenirs when I really looked hard. And I have rocks from everywhere. And some of them are even labeled, and most of them, I don't know where they came from. They were important at the time. And I'm learning, I don't resonate with nature as much as I resonate with the city. And I'm trying to learn, and I'm mostly afraid of nature. I grew up in New York City. I can handle the city. The subways, I'm fine, and, you know, the streets. And anyway, so when I thought of what was really important to me on my pilgrimage, I brought these. And I received these when I was 8 years old, and I was roller skating past this woman's house on West 20th Street. And I knew every crack because I fell all the time. I had skin knees constantly. And I don't know if this is why this woman came out of her house and gave me these. Possible. But her son was a missionary in Kenya. And for years and years, I don't know sandalwood. I don't know what these are made of. And they still have some sort of scent. That was 52 years ago. And there's still some little scent, or maybe it's in my imagination. But they've been with me, and I pull them out. This is what I go to constantly. When there's a crisis, when I'm leaving home and something that frightens me. And my husband had this little test or game or something. And if you were going to Mars and you knew you'd never be coming back, what would you bring with you? First thing, my rosaries. What else? And so anyway, so on my pilgrimage of life with skin knees, I keep going back to these, and that's most important to me in terms of my sacred objects.
Thank you. Okay, who else? Okay.
Just real quick, I had the privilege of going to Iona 2 years ago with my friend Elizabeth, who you've seen here with me. She's not here today, but we got to go to Iona 2 years ago. And I collected a few of these little limpet shells and made necklaces for friends. And I don't know how many I had, maybe six. And I have three left, and it's been 2 years. So if I haven't given them away yet, it's not going to happen. So I will model them. They're very simple. But if any of you want them, I will leave them on the table, and they're yours. A little part of Iona, if you like.
Okay.
Camino de Santiago, the pilgrimage route that goes to Santiago de Compostela. And in fact, there is a wonderful movie out right now at the Riviera. It's called The Way, Martin Sheen. And it's a story about a father whose son dies at the outset of that pilgrimage route. And so he goes to France, identifies the body, has it cremated, and takes the remains and walks the whole length with an assortment of interesting friends that he meets, and spreads the ashes all along until he gets to the Atlantic Ocean. It's really something. Well worth seeing. One of the icons of the pilgrimage in Santiago and in France and Spain is this character that you might see. He's actually a little-known saint, but we have a parish here called San Roque. This is Roque. This is Rocco.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And in his traditional iconography, besides having the seashells, which come from St. James of Compostela, they're called coqui, instead of having those, in addition to having seashells and a walking staff and a gourd for water, he's bearing a wound on his leg. The wound is associated by many pilgrims with things like the plague. He was also blessed with a dog who, according to legend, would sometimes lick the wound and heal it. So those of you who have healing dogs can relate. Else? Yeah, come on up.
I'd like to put a little addendum to
that. Oh, we have an addendum coming.
Come on up.
Come on up.
I should have brought it. I didn't think about it. In my village in Belgium, I come from a village of about 200 people, and we had a boom. We're 300 now. There's a chapel way outside of the village, a tiny little chapel, just a cubicle. As a roof, and every year we went there on a procession, you know, and it's to Saint Rock, and he's always with the exposed leg, etc. And we were told that he was the patron saint people prayed to when there was the plague, and my village was decimated with the plague 300 years ago. No, yeah, no, no, 700, 1300. And they had made a pit there, and they prayed to Saint Rock that if the plague would stop, they would build a chapel for him. And we suspect that's where they had buried all the dead. And the story goes that he was the son of a wealthy family in France, and the parents were the ruling lords there, the castle, etc. And they died in an accident, and he inherited everything. But all he wanted to do was go to pilgrimage to Rome. And he gave everything away, and just with his little sack on his back, he walked to Rome. But on the way, he was stopped by the plague, and he would just start helping people. He gave himself 100% into helping people until he came down with it. And he isolated himself in the woods because he knew by then that the plague was contagious. And he was just waiting for death. And the legend goes that a dog would visit him every day and bring him a loaf of bread. So the dog often is represented with a loaf of bread in his mouth, and he was licking his wounds, and he survived. And then he came back to the place of his birth, and people didn't believe him, and by then France had all these invasions. I forgot who had taken over his town. And when he claimed to be who he was, they threw him in prison. And they forgot about him, and they left him in solitary in a cell until he died. And when he died and they buried him, they undressed him, and they recognized him by his birthmark. He had the cross on his chest. And they built a cathedral in France to Saint Roch, and they attribute all the post miracles with the plague to he was a saint. Yeah. So anyway, that's my and I made a painting of my chapel. So I could bring it if you want.
Thank you. Okay, anyone else? Judy.
Martha, I have a book here, and it ties right in with your mention of St. Coleman. Because this is a book that I have on the table over there. It's called The Independence of the Celtic Church in Ireland. And it was written in the 1930s, and it's a whole book of proving that the Celts really didn't want to go with Rome. They wanted to be their own God. And they had a church going, their bishops were bishops, there was a bishop in every church, and the bishops were married. They had a great Celtic spirituality, Christianity there. And then Rome came along, and there was that Council of Whitby in 664. St. Coleman is the one who was on the side of, let's say, the way we are. And there was another saint, somebody else, that was arguing for Rome, and St. Coleman lost. So the Irish Church then, for 500 more years, fought it. So they really didn't come under the onus of Rome for 500 years after the Council of Whitby. So this is a little book that documents the whole thing, if anybody wants to read it.
Okay, thank you.
I think it was the Normans that invaded, and finally I wrote it out.
Anne wants me to talk about Tehard, but... I'm not. I mean, of course, Tehard permeates the book. And the reason Tehard was important for me, I did do my thesis for graduate work on his life and spirituality, is because for me at the time, I was looking for a way to bring God and the world together. This idea of this otherworldliness spirituality that I was raised with didn't fit with the ordinary everyday life that I have. So Tehard opened that up, and he permeates this book.
And
Tehard Desjardins is a French priest paleontologist who he did a lot of work bringing science and spirituality together. He was condemned by the church. He was pulled out of his position teaching in Catholic University in France, Paris, I think it was, and then he was exiled to do scientific work, and after he died, they didn't allow him to publish any of his works. After he died, some of his friends published his works. At first, they were embraced. He highly influenced Vatican II, but then they were pulled off the shelf, and now he's, of course, gained renewed importance, and not just within our church, in fact, not as much in our church as he has gained importance in other, I would say, new thought movement and other movements that are out there that have taken his thought because they're looking for ways to bring peace to the world. So he is embraced by everybody, not just a religious people, but by many different people. But that's not actually what I wanted to talk about. I love this book of Philip Newell's, and I love listening to him. When I listen to the prayers and even John O'Donohue, I'm transported to a whole new dimension. And reading this book was really a meditation for me. So this is just some of my thought on it. One of the many themes that he uses in Christ of the Celts is birthing. On page 54, he says, among the many things that the speakers have talked about, if there is to be a new birthing of Christ for today that serves the growing awareness of the oneness and sacredness of the earth, and if there is to be a new birthing within the Christian household of a wisdom that will fully serve the recovery of the divine feminine as well as the divine masculine within us, and among us in our lives and world, then we must learn to hear the heartbeat within the matter and deepest energies of the earth. In another place, he says, on page 36, the matter of life comes forth directly from the womb of God's being. Creation is forever being born. It is forever coming out of the womb of the eternal. And God forever sees what is being born as sacred.
I have been reflecting for quite a while now on the conversation between Jesus and Nicodemus in John's Gospel and what it means to be born anew. How can one return to the womb, Nicodemus asks. Jesus says, of course, one cannot literally return to the womb, but the spirit of the womb is where one is born again. What is this spirit of the womb? We have all been birthed from the womb of a woman, men and women alike. But that womb is beyond gender, a special place that can hold, nurture, and give birth to both male and female, the masculine phallic energy and the feminine receptive energy, the masculine energy that differentiates, the feminine energy that unites. There's no discrimination or hierarchy in these two energies that come together here. The womb is the place of the coincidence of opposites, able to hold and nurture both. Every man and woman has this spirit of the womb, both masculine and feminine, within them since it gave birth to them. So what is this womb, the spirit of the womb? Is it silence? Is it a field? Is it a garden? Is it the kingdom of heaven? Is it the New Jerusalem? I think it's all of those and more. It's the spirit of pure love. I remember my professor Daniel Smith Christopher at LMU saying, when speaking of the creation story in Genesis, that this story was told to emphasize that the Hebrew God was one who created with intention and compassion, not like the gods of surrounding nations who created out of war and conflict. I think a return to the womb, and this is through the path of silence, to the garden is where we can be born again and out of which we birth with compassion and intention a new world. Richard Rohr always says that you cannot think your way into union with God. You must experience it. It's in the silence that we experience our deep belovedness from all eternity. And that quilt of yours, Jim, to me, that core center is the womb out of which we were begotten. And then, in the spiral of the evolving universe, we were born into time. So that's a great spiritual.
The womb is a metaphor for creativity.
Right.
And that's what nourishes us.
So we were
all co-creators of the universe.
Exactly. We were begotten in that love and were born to manifest that love in time. So begotten from all eternity, born in time to manifest. But it's one continuous birthing. So I believe this is the specific role of women today, to access the deep feminine divine that is native to them, and through it to the primordial womb out of which all of creation has been birthed with intention and compassion. When we do this, we can help nurture this womb energy in men so they can reach the full potential of the masculine divine and complete this marriage mirroring. This may be the specific role of women my age, postmenopausal, having lived beyond the reproductive years. I do like Barbara Marx Hubbard's naming of this time as regenopause. The move from procreation to co-creation, from uniting genes to uniting genius. But anyhow, if they return, and I think the path is silence, I think we have to stop the noise, stop the flow of thought, and allow our roots to sink deep into this womb of love. The path for me for over 25 years has been silence. It's there that we can experience our belovedness.
Thank you. I believe isn't our speaker next week when we speak about Tihari? So we'll have more. Yes.
I have two things from my pilgrimages. One, a song from the pilgrimage to Israel, and the poem is a poem from my pilgrimage to Africa.
I'll hold it for you.
Thanks.
Okay.
And
I wanted to mention that this song is something I've been using the last couple of weeks to still my soul. My mouth. I am only at rest in worship. I am my best in worship. When I worship, I'm at rest. When I worship, I'm when I worship, I'm at peace. All stress finds total release whenever I simply
Irish, so that makes it okay if I go anywhere I go, right? It's all pilgrimage. Okay. I always love the story of this particular little story, and I call it, Did You Not See Him? Did You Not Know? We dearly want to touch one another, to connect heart to heart, pass by those interferences, the words, language, customs, that in ordinary life hold us together and yet separate us so we only touch form to form, which leaves us empty. Well prepared we are to greet the stranger, to be courteous, impenetrable, and gracious. How then did the risen ones come upon two friends walking to Emmaus? And in their conversation, how did he penetrate their fearful hesitation? How did he pierce their very hearts and minds and send them on their way transformed?
When John O'Donohue came to Santa Barbara for the Mine and Supermine, I was transfixed by his reading of his own poetry, And I spoke to him afterwards, and I told him that I felt that, the topic was Celtic spirituality, and I said that I felt that in this area, in California, that his what he had to say was well received, because I felt the strong Franciscan influence in this area, and he was delighted to hear that. He felt that was probably so, that there was such a link and a commonality. But that was a very delightful man to have an encounter with. As you can imagine, I've been charmed by all the musical references in the chapter titles and throughout the text. For personally, my experience has been that this, I guess it's the same place. I'm having just this kind of joyful immersion in nature, this connectedness, this oneness. I know several times over the last many years I've practically driven off the road, looking at the mountains. It just comes over me, and from some places like City College or whatever, I've looked out on the water, and the play of the sun, it just makes the channel look like a bowl full of diamonds. Just beautiful. Anyway, so 3 weeks ago, when Catherine Collis was our presenter, she began and ended with some verses from a blessing, and I recognized some of those lines as something that I had sung from my experience with the choir at the mission. So I'd like to offer this to you. Deep peace of the running wave to you. Deep peace of the flowing air to you. Deep peace of the quiet earth to you. Deep peace of the shining stars to you. Deep peace of the gentle night.